This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's generally understood now that comic books aren't just for kids, that the comic's combination of words and pictures can be used to tell funny or dramatic adult stories about work, love, family, war, whatever. And for that, we owe a debt of gratitude to my guest, Art Spiegelman. He demonstrated just how extraordinary the form could be with his 1986 book, Mouse, a memoir in the form of a comic about his relationship with his father, who survived the Nazi death camp Auschwitz. The second volume of Mouse won a special Pulitzer Prize in 1992. Spiegelman also co-founded the comics and graphics magazine Raw, which launched the careers of many artists. During his years with the New Yorker magazine, he designed some of their most memorable covers, including the cover after September 11th. On first glance, the image looks like solid black, but on closer examination, you see in a darker shade the ghostly silhouette of the two no longer existing towers. A version of that image is on the cover of his new book, In the Shadow of No Towers. The book is a fragmented diary in oversized comic book form of his experiences on September 11th, and the subsequent difficulty of distinguishing his own neurotic depression from well-founded despair. You say you spent much of the decade before September 11th trying to avoid making comics. Why did September 11th get you started cartooning again?
Oh, I kind of had one of those memento mori, end-of-the-world moments, and kind of figured that, it takes forever to do these comics, and you've misspent your years, like, avoiding it because it's too hard. And if you don't start now, there's not going to be much time because the world is ending, but maybe you can get a panel inked. Essentially, it was a renewal of vows, part of the many kind of reassessments that came in the wake of those towers tumbling.
You know, one of the great things about comics and of the kind of, you know, graphic book, you know, graphic nonfiction book that you've pioneered is that you have the marriage of words and image, and the two together have so much power. And I'm wondering, what were some of the images that stuck in your mind on September 11th that you felt you needed to draw?
Well, the main one, which I couldn't draw, was the glowing bones of the tower, 110 stories above us, two blocks away. That was an uncanny Armageddon-like image that I saw, Francoise, my wife, and Nadja, my daughter, all saw, and I couldn't represent properly. It's not something I was able to then find photo documentation for, like the ground zero in the rubble or the large toxic cloud that was going through New York City. But when we were standing on the near the West Side Highway, and the second tower just was about to fall, there was a moment that lasted forever, which was, I guess, just the beams or bones of the tower glowing yellow-white and evanescing into that blue sky around it, still solid and not solid, with it seeming to last forever. And then as it began to fall in on itself, it was replaced by that toxic white-gray cloud that came after all of us that was made of asbestos and human ashes. Maybe if I was a better pointillist, I could have painted it or something. But as it was, I eventually just found a way to make a very accurate, I think, representation of what I saw with the aid of Photoshop on the computer. And that's the main image that forms the spine of the book. It's the timeless moment that all the other little boxes that move in time jut out of.
How did it affect you to feel, okay, now I've got it. I've got it on the page.
It was like, good, that's one image I needed, you know? And then there are several others, like these pages, when I was starting them, they were really trying to sort out what I saw and felt, and then the project changed on me. I was making these one page at a time with the stupid conviction that I was going to probably be dead before the page got printed. It was done for mostly foreign newspapers and for the Forward in New York. And I guess it was a matter originally of trying to sort out what I saw as opposed to the images coming through the TV and the internet that were replacing what I saw. And among them were images like my startled daughter's face when she turned around and saw me in her school, trying to get her out. My daughter, who sort of had seen it all happening out her window, block out of Stuyvesant, the debris, the people falling, the fire, but didn't somehow accept it as fully real until, oh, gee, if Dad's here, there must be, something must be up. The image of two kids, two boys in the stairwell of Stuyvesant, one saying to the other, hey, they bombed the Pentagon, and the other one, slapping his palm, going, cool. a girl shrieking because she thought her mother might be in the tower across the way, a girl in the school shrieking. Images like that were what were making up my morning. Didn't see the tower, the first tower, fall because we were inside Stuyvesant High School and just felt the impact of the building reverberating and then everything going dark, and got outside to see those glowing bones that I described.
Let's talk a little bit about your September 11th story. The first thing you did when you found out about the plane hitting the first tower was to go to your daughter's school to try to get her out of school because she was in high school just a few blocks away from the World Trade Center. And in your book, you say that you think the school let you and your wife in because they thought that your wife was hysterical.
Well, yeah, she was there, and she's very present-minded. And as soon as the first tower got hit by a plane, which we saw live from 10 blocks away that morning, the towers are right outside our house, basically, she said, oh, we got to get down to the school immediately. And I kind of was still lagging in terms of catching up to real reality and wanted to go upstairs and telephone the school and ask if everything was okay and get Nadja ready to come out of the school. But, of course, phone lines went down almost immediately, and that wasn't possible. By the time we got to the school, Françoise was agitated enough to, insist on getting in, even though they weren't letting anybody from outside in. And so there were a handful of other parents around, and we got to be let in as the representative hysterical parents. So it was hysteria has its uses.
So you got her out, and when you got out, the next goal was to find your son, who was in the United Nations school, and you got him. And you describe in your book that after you got him, you broke down in tears, and that you thought that the sight of you weeping was even more frightening to your children than the catastrophe that had just happened in New York. And I'm just wondering if you wouldn't mind sharing what was going through your mind at that moment.
Mind? My mind. I don't think I really quite had one at that point. I really did believe the world is ending and we're moving through that. I didn't have the distance and luxury that came with what resulted from reporting to my television set like the rest of the world had. So the scale and scope of what was going on was really unclear in Lower Manhattan on the streets that day. So there really wasn't that much thought except the sky is falling.
No, when it came down for you to sit down and do your graphic version of what had happened, you had to figure out how to draw yourself. In Mouse, your Pulitzer Prize-winning book-length comic that was a memoir, you drew yourself as a mouse wearing your clothes, a mouse wearing your vest and your pants. And you did that because in Mouse, all of the Jews were portrayed as mice and all of the Nazis, your parents were Holocaust survivors, were portrayed as cats. But how did you decide to draw yourself in the new book about September 11th?
Okay. Well, I wasn't sure because I felt I'd really lost a personal sense of self in a way, and I didn't know how to represent that self. And there were certain sequences where that mouse mask was very convenient to have in place again, certainly when discussing the smell of the air in Lower Manhattan that day. On the other hand, I also would find myself not even knowing how to draw myself in terms of do I have a beard or not, because I seemed to be growing mine just about the time the Taliban was shaving its beard off. And so some panels have me bearded, some not, some drawn in one style, some in another, sometimes drawing myself as old cartoon characters. And it all came from the result of feeling like a basically shattered. And the form the shattering took was kind of a multifrenia, schizophrenia, but more than two, so that there were different selves all moving around in there, and sometimes one would dominate, sometimes another. But I had a very unclear sense of it. As a result, the first pages really were just written in the third person because that was more comfortable.
So what did you do? You go back and rewrote and redrew those parts of the story?
No. I left myself with my beard. I have some eyes. I have some
eyes. I see what you're saying. Okay, right.
This was never meant, these pages were not meant as a book, the way you just described Mouse. These were like provisional condensed diary entries, one a month, for a large broadsheet format that various newspapers and magazines were willing to indulge me and present. But they were never meant to last more than the day that they appeared and at the time I was making them. I didn't have an overarching plan except to kind of give a kind of barometric reading of what that month had been like in Lower Manhattan.
It sounds like after September 11th, you got very obsessive about September 11th. And in your new book, your character is saying doomed. He thinks he's doomed to drag this damned albatross around his neck and compulsively retell the calamities of September 11th to anyone who'll listen. And the albatross is saying things like, everything's changed, go out and shop.
Yep.
And so did you feel like you had become almost a broken record mentally and verbally, that you were thinking obsessively about it and speaking obsessively about it?
Well, I was kind of careening from it longer than some of my friends, but I still had a lot of other people who were obsessively talking about it as my neighbors and friends, and that was my daily life. I think my daughter was moving on well before I was, that's for sure. On the other hand, that albatross around my neck who's wearing an Uncle Sam hat is probably what kept me in the extended September 11th longer than I might have otherwise stayed there, in that right as I was trying to sort out what had happened to me, I felt that the hijacking that had brought down the towers had now itself been hijacked and given symbolic meaning as a war recruiting poster, and reduced to that as at a time when the tragedy hadn't been assimilated and where many other reactions were possible other than turning this into the events that have followed that all seemed to like emanate from September 11th politically. And so that image of the albatross is an American eagle who's telling us that everything's changed, go out and shop and basically be afraid and don't think.
Do you think it was good or bad for you mentally, not artistically, but just mentally, to have...
Talking to you is always like hanging out at a shrink's.
Yeah. Sorry. But, you know, I'm thinking here you are obsessed with the story, and then, but you're also obsessed with getting back to cartooning. So, of course, cartooning is just getting you deeper and deeper and deeper into that story, into what you saw on September 11th, into what you felt on September 11th. So what was the the mental effect of getting deeper and deeper through the work? A lot of people absorb themselves into work to take themselves out of an experience like that.
Yeah, I think that's why I get to say somewhere in my introduction that disaster is my muse.
Yes, know? Yes.
That for me, it's working through these things that are sources of pain and irritation that lets me kind of understand what it is that I'm living through, like getting to sort it out and put it into boxes.
My guest is Art Spiegelman. His new book is called In the Shadow of No Towers. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer and comic book artist Art Spiegelman. He won a Pulitzer Prize for the second volume of his book-length comic Mouse, a memoir about his relationship with his father, a Holocaust survivor. Spiegelman's new book, In the Shadow of No Towers, is a fragmented diary in comic book form of his experiences on September 11th and after. Spiegelman, his wife, and their two children live a few blocks from Ground Zero. Art Spiegelman, your new book, In the Shadow of No Towers, starts with an essay. And I'd like you to read the first paragraph of that essay.
Okay, the essay is called The Sky is Falling, Before the Ten Plates. I tend to be easily unhinged. Minor mishaps, a clogged drain, running late for an appointment, send me into a sky is falling tizzy. It's a trait that can leave one ill-equipped for coping with the sky when it actually falls. Before 9/11, my traumas were all more or less self-inflicted, but outrunning the toxic cloud that had moments before been the North Tower of the World Trade Center left me reeling on that fault line where world history and personal history collide, the intersection my parents, Auschwitz survivors, had warned me about when they taught me to always keep my bags packed.
Did they tell you to always keep your bags packed in case you had to flee, like the Jews had to flee in Europe?
Yeah, in a sense. I'm not sure that I remember that phrase specifically, but I got long lessons in how to pack a suitcase tightly when I was a kid from my father. And in a way, I think it helped me become a cartoonist.
How?
Well, you know, comics also have to have a lot of information densely packed, at least the way I understand them. And I'm serious in using that metaphor. I thought of it while I was working, that can you cram another thought in if you shorten the language elsewhere, or can you get another visual clue in this panel that would open up the meanings of what you're doing. And in a sense, it's like trying to make this very tightly packed, efficient visual and verbal chunk.
Well, they brought you up to prepare for the fact that there might be another disaster in which...
Yeah, that you're homeless, that essentially the world is a very provisional place and you're homeless in it.
Right, and that I'm sure they felt, too, that Jews in particular could be easy victims. I mean, that could easily be victimized, easily
it's true,
be
although when
persecuted.
They told me to pack... It's true, although when there was still a draft up, they were trying to get me to pack my bags and go to Canada quick.
Hmm.
I don't think they thought of it as anything personal. I wasn't going to be drafted because I was Jewish or anything. So it was that, all that and more.
Did you share any of that fear, or did you think that this was just them projecting their reality and their paranoia onto the world?
The perceptions that they instilled in me had an effect. I wouldn't have defined it as in the same terms that might occur now after September 11th. But nevertheless, it is true that I always felt sort of homeless wherever I've been. That it was actually September 11th that made me a lower Manhattan patriot, you know, somebody who loved my neighborhood and didn't think of it as replaceable. That up until that point, every place I was, even if I had been here for 30 years in a row, was still somehow provisional.
I guess I'm wondering, too, if September 11th, in its own way, fulfilled the expectations of doom that your parents instilled in you. Do you know what I mean?
I guess that's what I'm saying in that paragraph, is that for the first time, I was, like, not in any way to compare the scale of what happened or even my position in it. My parents were victims. I was a close-up witness. I wasn't trying to get out of a burning building or having to jump from a window. But I was all of a sudden caught in the nexus, as I say in that paragraph, of where my own personal story intersects with something that reverberates into far larger meanings and has import and consequences for many others.
I think it's in the new book that you say you finally understood that after September 11th, you finally understood why some Jews didn't leave Germany after Kristallnacht. And Kristallnacht was the night that a lot of Nazis went around shattering the windows of Jewish-owned businesses, basically signaling that time was up for the Jews there. It would no longer be safe. What is it that you understood, that you felt you understood about why some Jews didn't leave after Kristallnacht?
I guess what passed through my mind was the notion that we should get out of here. This is a dangerous place right now. And then the logical place for my family and I to go would be somewhere in France. And we'd be in France, and I'd be sitting in a cafe, opening up an International Herald Tribune, and reading that New York had just been incinerated because Indian Point had been bombed, or something like that, and realizing I couldn't live in a world that didn't have New York in it. It wasn't a world that made any sense to me. And I think that's what made me say the particular sentence you're quoting, which I didn't even remember saying, but Francois says was my first coherent sentence beyond hamana, hamana, hamana after we got off Canal Street. And what I was thinking, I suppose, was specifically that there were German Jews in Berlin who identified themselves thoroughly as Germans and felt that all of this was just a transient madness that would have to go away because they couldn't imagine a world in which they weren't Berliners. And that was analogous to what went through my head.
Of course, the Jews who felt that and who stayed behind, most of them were killed. Did you ever think that you were making a mistake by staying behind in New York?
Well, as the no smoking laws get heavier and heavier here in the city, I'm beginning to rethink my position. But for the moment, I do have this feeling, finally, of having a place that's home. Like Main Street in the Andy Hardy movies doesn't look a lot like Canal Street. And it's kind of insane collision of different cultures and noises and whatever. But it really finally hit me that, gee, that's the alleyway that leads home.
You coined a word that I quite like. You did this years ago, and the word is holokitch about the Holocaust. And I wonder if you've run into a lot of kitsch after September 11th.
Well, sure. In fact, the last of the pages is about this clock I almost bought but didn't, that I saw right near Ground Zero on September 11th, 2003, which had a kind of multicolored sculpted gunk. I don't know what it was made of, either snot or plaster, but it was a policeman on one side, a fireman on another, an eagle on the top, and a red, white, and blue motif on it, and a little clock stuck into all of that with the towers jutting out on either side. And it was a souvenir clock. But, you know, even on September 12th, that was one of the more amazing moments. September 12th, Canal Street, it's totally blocked off. You can't get there without a pass. Like, you're not allowed below Houston Street unless you can show that you live below Houston. And then you're not allowed below Canal without another pass, or even below 14th Street. I was living in this thoroughly gated community. Nobody was down there except T-shirt vendors with T-shirts that said, "I survived September 11th," being sold off the stoops, you know.
Art Spiegelman's new book is called In the Shadow of No Towers. He'll be back in the second half of the show. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Art Spiegelman. He helped prove that comic books could be a form to tell adult stories about anything, love, work, even the Holocaust. He won a 1992 Pulitzer Prize for his second volume of Mouse, his book-length comic about his relationship with his father, a Holocaust survivor. Spiegelman's new book is a fragmented memoir in comic form about his experiences on September 11th and the period after. It's called In the Shadow of No Towers. Spiegelman, his wife, and their two children live a few blocks from Ground Zero. You started Rum Magazine. You co-founded it in, I think it was around 1980, which was a magazine of comics, of avant-garde graphics. And then with Mouse, you kind of gave birth to the book-length graphic novel or work of nonfiction. And that's just kind of taken off. I mean, Everything that you started with Raw and with Mouse has just really expanded. I think, you know, really sophisticated, funny, adult comics are kind of a given of American culture now. And, you know, book-length comics are a given of American culture now. And I wonder, when you look out on this field, what you think about, knowing that you are one of the people who helped start it.
Yeah, I kind of wish I'd spent the last 30 years fighting for world peace rather than for the legitimacy of the comic book.
You probably would have been more effective at the comic book and the world peace stuff.
Well, I don't know. I mean, in a way, it seems that while the world is turning to sludge, to be polite about it, that seems to have been a wonderful moment for the comics to get reborn and find themselves a different slot in the culture to live and breathe. And it's kind of odd to me that it's doing so well when the rest of the planet's doing so badly.
In your very early career, you did some stuff for Tops, and basically you did like bubblegum cards and Garbage Pail Kids. And
ephemera, as they classify this
stuff. Yeah. And I'm wondering what it's been like for you as a father to watch the pop culture that your kids have grown up with.
I thought that Pokemon was invented specifically as a karmic payback for me having done Topps bubblegum, because all of a sudden there were bubblegum cards that were costing me $7 a piece to get for them. You know?
Do you have any second thoughts about any of the stuff you did when you were young, like the Garbage Pail Kids?
I have second thoughts of things I did when I was young, like started this interview or something. You know, it's like second thoughts are second nature. But no, I'm actually still very proud of the Wacky Packs, Garbage Pail Kids, things like that. It was the passing along the Mad Magazine lessons that malformed me.
Art Spiegelman is my guest, and he is the author of the Pulitzer Prize book-length comic Mouse. And now he has a new book-length graphic work called In the Shadow of No Towers. That's about September 11th. You write that after September 11th, a lot of people you knew were finding some kind of comfort or meaning through reading poetry. You turned to old comics. Why did you find something to hang on to in old comics?
Basically, the problem I was having with poetry, like the Auden poem, September 1st, 1939, that seemed to be read every time I was in a group of more than seven people, was I couldn't remember the one sentence when they started another. I'd just get lost in my own fugue state. And then I'd kind of tune in time for the punchline of how we must love one another or die. So it wasn't something I was able to hang on to and get much comfort from. And I wasn't able to really, like, listen to music at all for months afterwards, any kind of music. It was too beautiful. And most things just seemed like they had too much majesty for the moment. And what I found was these old comics seemed humble, and that seemed appropriate at the moment, and they seemed ephemeral. They weren't made to be seen after the day they were made. Most of those old comic strips were part of just one news cycle. They were to be read and then used to wrap fish. As a result, some of the pages that ultimately appear as part of what I think of as the second tower after my plates, which are these old pages, were really hard to dig up and have something to reproduce from. In one instance, there's a Lionel Feininger Kinder Kids page. Feininger's better known as a Bauhaus and Cubist painter. His fine art prints, which sell for many thousands of dollars, are much... there are more copies of those on the planet than of the Kinder Kid comic that appeared in one newspaper. And if it hadn't been for Nicholson Baker, I wouldn't have been able to use it in my book, because he had rescued a lot of old newspapers, including the Chicago Tribune that had that 1906 page. So it was real ephemera. And I think because it was ephemera and because it wasn't made for posterity, it had the breath of life to it. It was like watching somebody dance in 1907. Not on film even, but just watching them live their lives. These were just working stiffs, not artistes, working in a newspaper building, expressing as much of themselves as they could against a front page of a newspaper in which the world was ending also, but in different ways than it's ending now. And that just seemed so lively, so vital, and so beautiful that it provided me with the happy ending that's the second half of my book.
And you write, too, how you like the contrast of the fact that, you know, although the Twin Towers, which were built to last, were destroyed and no longer existed, this ephemera
exactly.
hung
what,
on.
What
it
had been monumental
there.
Seemed ephemeral. What yeah. was ephemeral has begun to seem more monumental. Governments seem transient. Civilizations seem transient. And one's culture is what survives the civilization. So that while America was being very cavalier with the museum cultural artifacts of Baghdad and was instead just protecting its oil fields, it seems to me that the reason that most people were turning to poetry, to music, to art in general, was a way of giving themselves not only the comfort of what can come from the beauty people have made, but also from the looking for a justification to have our civilization continue, you know, by finding that which might last.
Well, Art Spiegelman, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
Art Spiegelman's new book is called In the Shadow of No Towers.